Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The study of full contact sports and concussions continues to grow. A new study from UCLA that looked at the brains of former pro football players includes scans that have shown protein deposits similar to those in Alzheimer's patients. Joining us now to talk about this research is Dr. Gary Small. He's the director of the UCLA Longevity Center and co-author of The Alzheimer's Prevention Program. It's out in paperback recently. Welcome to the show, Dr. Small.
Thank you.
Your new study looked at the brain of five former NFL players. Why those five, and what were you looking for?
Well, we've spent many years studying Alzheimer's disease and the aging brain and invented a new kind of PET scan tool that allows us to see the physical evidence of Alzheimer's for the first time in living people, in their brains. And one of the deposits in Alzheimer's is called tau protein or tau deposits. We had known from autopsy studies that many NFL players, military personnel have a constellation of symptoms, depression, cognitive impairment, dementia, and when they die, there are these tau proteins collected in the brain. So we thought it might be important to study these people while they're living, see if we could identify those tau proteins while they're living, hopefully to predict what's going to happen to them and help prevent problems. We picked these players because they had histories. Most of them had histories of depression or dementia. And when we did the scans, we saw an interesting finding that the constellation or the way those proteins were deposited in the brain, it was almost identical to what was seen at autopsy.
When you said you had histories of depression or dementia, why depression?
The number of these players who we've heard about in the news have not only had depression symptoms, but they've had suicidal behaviors. Some have committed suicide. And we also see, interestingly, when we study people with depression, we see some of these protein deposits as well. So there's clearly an overlap of cognitive symptoms or memory symptoms, depressive symptoms in the brain, and these proteins seem to be associated with those kinds of problems.
Ultimately, what is the difference between is dementia just a more of a generic term and Alzheimer's more specific? What's the relationship between those two words?
Dementia is a generic term. It basically means a memory and cognitive impairment that interferes with life, so you need help from others.
Okay.
A lot of things can cause dementia. You can get it from small strokes, a thyroid imbalance, even depression can cause a reversible dementia or medication side effects. Alzheimer's disease is the most common cause of dementia, and you see a gradual progression and onset, and these collections of these tiny protein deposits in areas of the brain that control memory and other mental abilities.
You were looking for that certain protein in the brain, and you referred to it as constellations of the protein. What's the significance of the constellation formation of it?
I think maybe that wasn't the best term.
Okay.
I think it was really the pattern of deposition.
Okay.
So we look in different parts of the brain for these proteins. In Alzheimer's disease, there are definite areas where it collects first and progresses. We've studied this systematically for many years. In what the condition called chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, which is a condition that's only at this point diagnosed at autopsy, you see the pattern of deposition in different areas of the brain, what we call subcortical areas deep inside the brain, and actually an area called the amygdala that controls emotion. So it's not surprising that these individuals have mood symptoms. And in our study, we matched up these players with non-players who were about the same size and age, and we found there was not only higher mood symptoms in the players, but there was also higher deposition in the amygdala, the mood center of the brain.
So how does that particular protein, how is it produced and how does it affect brain function?
We're still learning about it. We know when it's normal tau, it actually helps maintain the integrity of the cells. It actually is part of the cell wall. And what happens is it becomes malformed, it becomes fibrillar, little fibrils deposit, and we think it may mess up the brain cell firing, or it may be a consequence of some other problem in the brain. We found, for example, in Alzheimer's disease, and I get into this in the book, The Alzheimer's Prevention Program, that there's a problem with inflammation. And we think also that occurs with head trauma. After somebody has acute head trauma, you see these abnormal protein deposits, and you also see inflammatory cells, which generally are normal. They kind of clean up the debris in the brain and in other parts of the body. But when there's a disorder, sometimes they get into high gear, and these inflammatory cells attack normal brain cells rather than tissue that needs to be cleared out.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and my guest is Dr. Gary Small. He's director of the UCLA Longevity Center. He's also co-author of the Alzheimer's Prevention Program. We have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question for Dr. Small, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. So how much higher were the levels in the football players than what you would expect in an average person of the same age?
So it was significantly higher, and it was enough to see that in each area of the brain where autopsy studies of CTE have shown the tau deposit, in each of those areas, there was a statistically significant difference between the levels of the protein in the players compared to the people from everyday life. Another important finding was that when we looked at the level of deposition in the brain and we plotted that against the number of concussions in the players, that there wasn't a significant relationship, but it was a trend. And we didn't expect it to be significant because we only have five players. Mm-hmm. But I think the reason we decided to publish this preliminary report is that the findings were so striking to us, and they were so consistent with what we predicted scientifically, and we wanted to get it out there in the scientific community so other people would try to replicate this and we could move the field forward.
Were you surprised that all five showed these kinds of deposits of this protein this way?
Sometimes, you think through a scientific experiment and you get it right. It's happened a few times in my career. So, I was glad, I'm not glad that these players are suffering, but I was glad that we saw that because it offers us an opportunity to help them, not only professional players, but we're talking about amateur athletes, military personnel, people who've had car accidents, any kind of head trauma. If we can develop a way to detect a problem in the brain early, that offers us an opportunity to develop prevention interventions or treatments to protect a healthy brain rather than try to repair damage once it becomes extensive.
So what kind of preventative measure could be taken at this point? You talked about to developing something, but if early detection is the key, what sorts of things could you do?
Well, first of all, we can use this in future studies to really develop it, understand when the high protein content predicts a problem when it doesn't. For example, one of the players in the study was in his mid-60s and didn't have cognitive problems, yet he had the protein. And why is that? There's got to be genetic issues that we have to study and understand. And this way we can do the test, and we're doing this in people before they have Alzheimer's disease. We're studying treatments to see if we can prevent the buildup of the protein and prevent the development of the disease. So we can use it in these scientific experiments. It might be used to decide when to keep an athlete out of the game, to heal the brain. I mean, if you sprain an ankle and you go back and play too soon, it's going to get much worse. And the same thing is true about the brain. We've got to rest it appropriately so that it can heal before we subject it to further trauma. Now, while we're waiting for science to catch up, there's a lot we can do to keep our brains healthy. And this is what I detail in the Alzheimer's Prevention Program. Mm-hmm. And it's really several things: physical aerobic conditioning, healthy brain nutrition, trying to manage stress. And as people age, they have memory decline, and we teach them simple, effective techniques to compensate for that decline.
Ajit, in Columbus, yes. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Dr. Small, I'm just wondering, is there any way to know if these players that you guys studied would have developed Alzheimer's later on? Like, because I'm just wondering if this maybe football hastened it, or if it's sort of coincidental, I suppose. Hmm.
So those are always questions we try to understand. Is it the chicken or the egg? And trying to determine a cause and effect relationship is the key to more long-term studies. This is a snapshot. And what we plan to do is to scan more players, follow them over time. There is some evidence to support the idea that the concussions are leading to diseases like Alzheimer's. A study that was published about a month ago found that NFL players have a 4-time greater risk of dying from Alzheimer's disease than people in the general population. And other studies have found with the general population, if you have a concussion and it leads to unconsciousness for an hour or more, that will double your risk for Alzheimer's disease.
What has the response been from professional players when you request these kinds of these participants, when you ask for their participation? How do they respond? Are they eager to find out?
Most of them are very interested in participating. They want to help. They want to move the science forward. Some people don't want to know, and I think we see the same thing in the general population with Alzheimer's disease. We have 80 million baby boomers who started turning age 65, coming to the risk, and there are now these scans where they can see the proteins in their brain before they get symptoms. Some want to know, some don't want to know. I think it's very important for research. As far as a practical tool, it will probably be more useful if it is connected to a specific treatment, much the way a cholesterol test is connected to a statin cholesterol-lowering drug.
Well, thank you for joining us today to talk about it, Dr. Small. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you for your interest.
It's Dr. Gary Small. He's the director of the UCLA Longevity Center. He's also the co-author of the Alzheimer's Prevention Program. It's just out in paperback. We have a link to it on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. When we return, we'll turn to another topic, very common, bad breath. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station. 57 degrees with steady temperatures in the upper 50s today. Then those temperatures will begin to drop with a chance of rain mixing with snow and a low of 25 degrees overnight tonight. There's a slight chance of snow on Thursday and colder, a high of just 28. Support comes from the Thurber House, presenting New York Times bestselling author Chris Pavone reading from his debut novel, The Expats, this Wednesday evening, January 30th at 7:30 p.m. at the Columbus Museum of Art. Tickets and more information at thurberhouse.org. And support comes from the Midland Theater, presenting Arlo Guthrie's solo tribute to Woody Guthrie's 100th birthday. It's Tuesday evening, February 19th at 7:30 p.m. Many of Woody Guthrie's songs are about his experiences in the Dust Bowl era during the Great Depression. More information and tickets at MidlandTheater.org.
Start your day with local updates from the award-winning WOSU News Team.
The richest deposits of oil and natural gas in Ohio's Utica Shale Formation are believed to be in the foothills of Appalachia. There's new demand for workers, but industry officials say too few qualify, in part because they cannot pass a required drug screen.
This is becoming a bigger problem, or people are finally...
Hear the latest in local and national news on Morning Edition on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station. We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, William H. Macy. In the Showtime series Shameless, he plays an alcoholic father of six who each week stoops to new depths to scam and manipulate others.
We sit down, we read these scripts, and everybody's covering some part of his or her face going, "Oh my God, are you kidding?" Well, that's why it's called Shameless.
Join us.
Today at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back. We have a slight technical difficulty right now. We're trying to get to it. But coming up, we're going to be talking about bad breath. Everybody knows somebody with the problem. And we want to know, hear from you if you have any questions. We're going to, joining us to talk about bad breath is Dr. Harold Katz. He's a dentist and founder of the California Breath Clinics and the author of the Bad Breath Bible. Who knew there was such a thing? So how can people have bad breath? Some people have bad breath all the time, and for others, it's never a problem. And more importantly, is chronic bad breath a signal that perhaps something more serious is wrong? Do you have bad breath? Do you know somebody who does? Do you have a question about it? Why don't you get on the horn right now? 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me on Twitter, too, at Ann Fisher, WOSU. Dr. Harold Katz, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
So what is the major cause of bad breath besides just not brushing your teeth?
Many people think it has to do with foods that you eat, onions and garlic, et cetera, which will obviously will give you bad breath. But most bad breath is actually caused by bacteria, bacteria that live in the back of your tongue, throat, and tonsils. And they produce chemicals called volatile sulfur compounds. Those are things like hydrogen sulfide, that's the rotten egg smell. Another chemical is called cadaverine. Another is called putrescine. So you can imagine what they smell like. So that's what you actually smell in real serious bad breath. When onions and garlic, the smells in those foods are very similar to the sulfur compounds produced by bacteria. So essentially, if you smell something bad on someone's breath, if it goes away fairly rapidly, that's a food odor. But if it's chronic, if it's what we term halitosis, that's bacterial in nature.
And where does the bacteria come from in the first place? Why do some people have it and others don't?
Well, the bacteria that cause the problem are actually part of the normal oral flora. They actually live in the mouths of everyone on the face of the earth, particularly in the back of the tongue, throat, and tonsils. What triggers bad breath in about a third of the population that has chronic bad breath are things like dry mouth, large tonsils, which trap many of the bacteria, people who have rougher tongues, which will trap more of the bacteria, post-nasal drip, diet, such as too much alcohol, too much smoking, too much sugar. They all cause a reaction with these bacteria so that they end up producing more sulfur compounds than a spouse or a friend that may have the same bacteria but not have the bad breath problem.
Gum disease is behind a lot of bad breath.
Very true. The bacteria that cause gum disease are very closely related to the bacteria that cause bad breath. Actually, some research very recently showed that people that have chronic bad breath are much more prone to have gum disease. It's sort of a reverse of what people used to think, that first was gum disease and then bad breath. But now research shows that people that have chronic bad breath may end up getting what we term, you know, spongy gums, a gingivitis, because the sulfur compounds in bad breath tend to make the gum tissue very soft, more susceptible to bleeding, which then allows these bacteria to get under the gum line and then start to eat away the supporting structures that keep our teeth inside of our mouth. So what we try to do here in our clinic in Los Angeles is try to instruct people on how to keep their breath fresh, which turns out actually to help them improve their gum tissue as well.
Should if you know somebody who has a chronic problem like this, would they necessarily know it themselves? I guess the ultimate question being, should you tell them?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. I'm glad you asked that, because people that have bad breath, you sort of think, well, don't they know that they're stinking up the place? And the reality is they don't. You cannot smell your own breath. I'm sure you see in TV and movies where the nerdy fellow cups his hand and blows into it.
Right.
That happens to be a great way to smell your hand, but it doesn't give you any indication about your breath. So the way for your listeners, if they want to test their breath, what you do is you lick the back of your hand, let that dry for a couple of seconds, and then smell that. And the reason that works as a fairly good test, those sulfur compounds I mentioned earlier blend in with your saliva. Once the liquid evaporates, if you do have bad breath, the sulfur will stick to your hand. Now, in our clinics, we use an instrument called a halometer. It actually measures the concentration of sulfur in parts per billion. And generally speaking, any concentration above 100 parts per billion is enough where someone would consider that unpleasant. Now, if you don't have access to a $3,000 halometer, you can use the hand licking test. Now, as far as letting people know, we actually have a service through our website, therabreath.com. It's called the Tell a Friend program. So let's say, for example, your boss has bad breath, and you're a little bit too skittish to let them know that they're offending people. If you come to our website, you give us the offender's email address. There's a link. It's called the Virtual Breath Mint. Click on that. A link pops up. You fill out the form, give us the offender's email address. It's all anonymous. We won't say that Ann told us your breath thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's all anonymous. And it's my job to inform people that they may have a bad breath problem. It's all nicely worded, of course. We're not out to insult people. But what we do in the email, we let them know that quite often it's medications they're taking that could lead to bad breath. The majority of medications have dry mouth as a side effect, which could lead to bad breath. There could be large tonsils. It could be dairy foods, which cause bad breath in people that are lactose intolerant. So we have a way of getting around the problem if you're too chicken to tell someone their breath thing.
But you should care enough to do it. I mean, it could be the sign of something more serious.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. If someone has chronic bad breath and you're close to them, you definitely have to let them know, because, as you say, it could be the sign of something. One of the most common, related problems are diabetics. Diabetics tend to have bad breath problems, because they tend to have a dry mouth. The more dry your mouth is, the more you're susceptible to producing these sulfur compounds. Those bacteria love a dry mouth. And we've actually diagnosed quite a few diabetics in our dental office, in our clinic, because people just unaware of the fact of the close relationship between diabetes, bad breath, and gum disease as well. Now, there could be, in more rare cases, people that have lung problems, kidney disease, liver disease, which may have a side effect of bad breath. And people have post-nasal drip and sinus problems as well. The actual mechanism by which these bacteria create odors is they're breaking down proteins. And there's proteins available in mucus, so people who tend to have colds and things like that will tend to have a bad breath problem. And people who are on some of these diets, with high-protein diets, will also tend to have bad breath because you're overloading the mouth with proteins, which the bacteria convert into sulfur compounds.
My guest is Dr. Harold Katz. He's a dentist and bad breath expert. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're talking about bad breath right now. You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Mike and Gahanna, you're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. Question. Thanks for taking my call, Ann.
Mm-hmm.
Question.
Sure.
I've noticed that the folks that have not eaten in quite a while will also have bad breath, and that includes myself. What would be the cause of that? And is there a remedy without having to chow down something to?
That's very true. I'm glad you brought that up. Yes. The reason that happens is twofold, mostly because your mouth becomes dry. We actually did a study on people that skip breakfast, and they tend to have the morning breath problem that lasts throughout the day because you need saliva. Saliva more or less is nature's way of remedying bad breath. That's why babies rarely have bad breath. They have plenty of saliva. As we get older, we produce less and less saliva. And if you're taking certain medications, along with not eating to kickstart your saliva production, you may end up with a chronic bad breath problem. The solution is to drink a little bit of water. To drink as much water as possible throughout the day, but never to skip breakfast. Eat something first thing in the morning to kickstart your saliva. You need to get that started. And there are certain mints and lozenges you can suck on, but make sure they are sugar-free. You need to kickstart it somehow, and xylitol is a good ingredient in many of these lozenges or candies if you want to suck on that to get your saliva started.
So it's actually the sugar-free nature of the candy or the mint or gum that is what kickstarts it?
Well, it's that plus the tartness. Many of the lozenges, anything which has a citric acid or lemony, will actually be very good to kickstart saliva production.
Okay. Mike, thanks for your call.
Appreciate it.
Take care.
Sure.
Dennis and Marion, you're on the air. Welcome, Dennis.
Hi. Oh, I had a question about permanently killing off bacteria. I know there's oil of oregano, and I've tried, myself used hot Epsom salts, and I used Listermint with it. And I've actually had two cases where I should have had a root canal, and I actually it killed off the bacteria and stopped the infection. I had a dentist that proved it. But I'm just wondering, and I also eliminated gum bleeding that way. Is there any way, a real effective way of killing off bacteria sufficiently in one, either through a process where it does not grow back until you're reinfected?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, you can kill off bad bacteria. What you do not want to do is kill off good bacteria because you may end up with an oral yeast infection, something called thrush or candida. What happens is your mouth needs to be in balance, and these bacteria that cause bad breath, for example, are not bad bacteria. However, if you have gum disease, one very simple technique that people have used for a number of years is to combine baking soda and peroxide for a short time period, and that will make the gums a lot healthier. But again, it's short time period. You'll kill off infectious bacteria. You don't want to kill off the good bacteria. Now, there's a new treatment that we've actually been used in our clinics for a number of years, and now it's available online. It's a probiotic. It's actually developed in New Zealand, and it replaces bad bacteria with good bacteria that help to prevent gum disease, bad breath, and sore throats. It's something called Bliss. And we have it available on our website, therabreath.com, and it's also at some Walgreens stores. It was actually developed in New Zealand. The government of New Zealand found that the people were increasing the numbers of gum disease and sore throat. So with one of the universities, they developed a specific oral bacteria, not type of bacteria for gut problems. These are bacteria for the mouth. So you can see it at therabreath.com or at some Walgreens stores.
Thank you, Dennis. Good luck. Gabriella in Cleveland, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Hi.
Hi, okay. Well, since I was a young child, I noticed that I was told by family members, did you brush your teeth? Go brush your teeth. So I might have had bad breath since an early age. As an adult, I started noticing I had what they're called tonsil stones.
Oh, yeah.
That would be
yeah.
lodged in little crevices in my tonsils. And I managed to start being able to kind of get them out. And they
yeah.
had a very foul odor. You know, you wonder, what is this in my body? So you take a whiff and you're like, oh, my goodness. And I noticed that when I had those, I obviously had bad breath as well. So I wondered, is there a way to avoid that from happening, from having your body produce
yes.
those things?
Yeah, yes, there is. I'm glad you brought up the question because it's a very common question.
Well, what are they?
Don't know. Okay, what is it? A combination of mucus and bacteria. You have to have several things happening at the same time to get tonsil stones. One is postnasal drip. The second is to have very large cryptic tonsils where the bacteria sort of hide. Once the mucus gets into those little crypts, the bacteria start to produce these almost, it looks like cottage cheese. pieces. They grow over a period of time. They smell terrible. Now, the reason I know about this is my daughter had this problem. And one reason why I started to specialize in bad breath is about 20 years ago, my own daughter had a bad breath problem due to tonsil stones. So we actually developed a system. It combines nasal drops and a spray that will dissolve the tonsil stones. What you do not want to do is have your tonsils removed because you still will have the bacteria on the back of the tongue. Removing the tonsils in adults is extremely difficult. So I would suggest we have something called the tonsil stone kit at therabreath.com, therabreath.com. And the combination of the nasal drops and the spray will dissolve the tonsil stones, and then the oxygenating solution and the formulas will remain in the tonsil to prevent the stones from forming again.
So it'll keep them from forming again. It'll prevent them in the future.
Right, because the oxygen compounds and the formulas that we use are the natural enemy of the anaerobic bacteria. Once you have the oxygen compounds available in the throat and in the mouth, the anaerobic bacteria can't do their nasty stuff. They still do what they're supposed to do, breaking down proteins, but they won't create tonsil stones or create odors. So that's more or less the things that we've developed in our clinics here in Los Angeles.
Gabriella, thanks a lot for your call. We appreciate it. Oh, take care. Yep. Tina, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Tina.
Hello. Thank you for receiving my call.
You're welcome.
I had a question. I had some rotten teeth in my mouth, and I got that situation all taken care of. But I'm still receiving the bad breath, and I don't know if they filled in teeth that were supposed to be removed. Could that be causing the bad breath? Or I'm not sure. What could I do about that?
Well, it's very possible that the odor is not coming from the teeth themselves, but from the gum tissue around it. Do you floss every day?
Yes.
Okay. What I would suggest is, you live in Cleveland?
I live in Columbus, Ohio.
Oh, Columbus. Okay. There's the product that we developed in our clinics. It's called TheraBreath. What you do is take a piece of dental floss, dip it in the TheraBreath mouthwash, and then floss in between the teeth. That will get the oxygen compounds under the gum line and kill the odor coming from between there. Generally speaking, dentists in America will not fill a tooth that has decay in it. The dentistry in America is good. I can't say the same for England, where I travel quite a bit. But in the U.S., I wouldn't worry about that. I'm sure they've done a good job. But getting under the gum line is the key. So the combination of using just plain old dental floss, dipping it in some of the TheraBreath mouthwash, will get rid of the odors and actually make the gums a little bit stronger, too. So try that. The second thing I'd like you to try is get some vitamin C supplements. That will make the gum tissue a lot stronger. It helps with the collagen, which is the infrastructure of gum tissue. So you want your gums as strong as possible to support those teeth.
Okay.
All right,
Thank
Tina.
You so much.
All right, Tina,
okay,
good
you're
luck.
Welcome.
Dr. Katz, I want to let you go, but first, how many people in this country are struggling with this kind of issue? I mean, do dentists typically bring it up to their patients?
They don't bring it up. And in fact, you know, I went to UCLA School of Dentistry, a good dental school, and all they talk about it with bad breath is just brush and floss. They don't talk about the bacteria as much as they should. So about a third of the population has a bad breath problem. Many of the things that I just discussed here, we actually have a book out called The Bad Breath Bible. It's 55 pages, and it mentions many of the medications which may lead to bad breath. So if listeners want a copy, they can just it's free. They can call my office. It's 800-557-6960. 800-557-6960. And we'll even throw in some samples of the TheraBreath mouthwash and toothpaste and lozenges, too. I like Ohio very much. So.
Okay.
I'm from Pennsylvania originally, so we're neighbors.
All right. Well, Dr. Katz, thanks for joining us today to talk about this. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. I'm glad you called me.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Dr. Harold Katz, he's a dentist and founder of the California Breath Clinics and author of The Bad Breath Bible. Coming up, we're going to talk about menopause. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, William H. Macy. In the Showtime series Shameless, he plays an alcoholic father of six who each week stoops to new depths to scam and manipulate others.
We sit down, we read these scripts, and everybody's covering some part of his or her face going, "Oh my God, are you kidding?" Well, that's why it's called Shameless.
Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. And tomorrow, NPR science correspondent Joe Palca will be in Columbus to lead a discussion on personalized genomics. RSVP at healthscienceforum.com. And expect rain showers off and on today, steady temperatures in the upper 50s, and then temperatures will drop dramatically overnight tonight. A chance of rain mixing with snow and a low of 25. Support for 89.7 comes from the State Auto Insurance Companies, providing home, automobile, and business insurance products and services to Central Ohioans since 1921. State Auto is on the web at stateauto.com. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Dan Fisher. The World Health Organization predicts that by the year 2030, the world population of postmenopausal women will increase to 1.2 billion, and that by then, 47 million women will be entering menopause each year. That's a lot of hot flashing going on out there. Joining us now to talk about menopause and what we are learning about it is Dr. Marjorie Gass. She's a gynecologist and the executive director of the North American Menopause Society. For our listeners, do you have a question about menopause? You can give us a call right now, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Dr. Gass, considering the number of people going through it at any given time, is the issue garnering a proportional increase in study or concern in the medical community?
Yes, it is, and fortunately, too, because it's a complex topic. It's so intertwined with aging, so it's hard to tease out what is due to hormonal changes and what's due to aging, and there is a lot of research going on, fortunately.
Are women told enough about menopause going forward? There's always a lot of concern about that first period and menstruation when they're younger. Do we spend enough time learning about it as we age and getting into menopause?
Perhaps not, but I think part of the problem is that we're so engaged in our life before menopause, we don't really want to think much about it till we get there, and then we need a crash course to deal with it.
Do you have to go to a physician to know that you are in menopause, or can you diagnose it yourself?
The answer is sometimes.
Okay.
So if you're the lucky woman who has regular periods and they slowly get slightly irregular and then just stop and you have a few symptoms, you pretty much can diagnose yourself. But for women who are having those questionable symptoms younger than 40, they should probably see their provider to review their whole health history and to determine what else is going on. The classic pattern is the normal cycles, then a change of plus or minus 1 week in the interval, and then skipping some months altogether, and then going back to cycling, and then finally stopping. And so that, I think most women can recognize. Of course, we always have to be sure we're not pregnant, and that's something very important.
Some people say that they never experience any symptoms of menopause. Is that possible?
And yes, it is.
Can we hate them?
You're entitled. If you're one that has a horrible menopause symptoms, you are entitled to have a little misgiving towards somebody else. But it's true. It's like everything in women's lives. Some women have absolutely no cramping with their periods, and other women cannot get out of bed, cannot get to work. Pregnancies, some women love them, some people are sick the entire time, and menopause is no different. It's just another phase or transition in a woman's life that varies dramatically from woman to woman.
Where do hot flashes come from, and do they ever go away? And people say they can go on for years at least.
Yes, a lot of variability in that as well. We don't know the exact mechanism. We believe it's a change in the thermoregulatory center in the brain, but why some women then see hot flashes as a result, we do not know. We know they affect about 75% of women. And then, of course, there's a wide range of how severe they are. Some people just feel a little warm. Other people break out in a full sweat. Their hair is wet, wakes them up with wet night clothes. So it's the whole range.
It has to do with hormones, right?
Yes, yes. And that can happen any time. So some women even get a few hot flushes after childbirth because their hormones drop then as well. And then I think the other really important thing I would like your listeners to know is that they can then recur if you were to take hormone therapy and then stop it. A lot of women don't appreciate that fact. Hot flashes are not age-related. They're related to a drop in estrogen, and your body doesn't care where that drop came from, whether it's pregnancy childbirth drop, menopause drop, or stopping hormone therapy drop.
My guest is Dr. Marjorie Cass. She's a gynecologist and executive director of the North American Menopause Society. If you have a question about menopause, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So what kind of research is going on out there about menopause? What questions do we have that scientists are trying to find an answer to?
A lot of questions. Hormones affect so many different aspects of our bodies that people can specialize in any one aspect of that to see what's happening. There are other things as to why do some women have symptoms, other women don't. Symptoms aren't even the same globally. For example, in Asian societies, the complaint is more joint aches and pains and not so much hot flashes. We don't know why symptoms vary around the world. So those are other intriguing factors. Of course, people are always trying to look for alternative ways of treating hot flushes besides hormone therapy. So whether that's lifestyle, whether it's over-the-counter products, and even non-hormonal prescription drugs are being investigated. It's very interesting that some of the antidepressants can reduce the number of hot flashes.
What about sleeplessness? That's often attributed to menopause and hormone changes. Is that the case?
Partially, it is. If your sleep is being disrupted by hot flashes, then certainly. And sometimes they're called night sweats at night, but it's the same thing. So that would certainly be disruptive. And whenever your sleep is disrupted several times a night, that takes a toll on how you feel the next day. But we also have changes associated with aging, and men can experience some of those sleep changes as well. A lot of people, as they get older, will complain of early morning awakening. So there are changes that just happen in our quality of sleep as we get older as well, another place where aging and hormones overlap.
Hormone therapy, you mentioned it a few minutes ago. Is that increasing or declining in use? I guess, first of all, what does hormone therapy involve?
Hormone therapy involves taking estrogen, and if you still have a uterus, you need to have a progesterone along with that, because we learned back in the 70s, if we gave estrogen alone to women, there was more cancer of the uterus. So if you have a uterus, you need to get the appropriate amount of progesterone to balance that estrogen. If you've had a hysterectomy, you can take estrogen alone. And there are many, many products. It comes in pills and creams and gels, vaginal rings, for example. So there are many ways to deliver hormones to the body. They all work, and so it's a matter of patient preference.
And is use of hormones therapy therapies, is it declining or is it increasing or what?
Hormone therapy has been a pendulum for the last 40 years. They first started using it on a widespread basis way back in the 60s, thinking it was the fountain of youth and would cure everything, prevent all the diseases of aging. We know that's not true. And then they found endometrial cancer was increased, so people stopped taking it. Then they found out that adding the progesterone would eliminate the endometrial cancer, so it swung back the other way. It has been going back and forth for decades. Recently, 2002, Women's Health Initiative showed that in a wide range of older women, combined estrogen progestin therapy increased the risk of breast cancer after 4 to 5 years of use. So that was learned, and that caused a big drop in prescribing once again. Now we have found out that if you look at women just closer to menopause, and if they are the ones that take hormone therapy, the risks are much lower for things like heart attacks and strokes. So we're not recommending anymore that women of all ages, older, 60s, 70s, start hormone therapy. But for women who are bothered by the symptoms, they are quite safe for the women who are just newly menopausal. So it's increasing in that age group, not across the board in all older women.
Anne in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. Hi, Anne.
Oh, hi. Thank you. My question is, I went through menopause in my early 40s. I'm now 51. I haven't had a period in 10 years, and my body's suddenly changing in my 50s. It seems like things happened early for me, and I just wondered if you could tell me what I could expect.
Well, I'm not sure what aspects of change you're referring to. Are you talking about more just changes with getting older?
Probably. Is it common to be all through menopause at so early an age?
Well, yes, it can be, because we consider normal 40 to 60, really. Most people are done by 55.
Okay.
But that's a very wide range of normal.
Yeah.
Yes, and so, you know, we always hear that average age is 51, and that's true. So women are often then quite surprised if they're one of the people who have menopause in their 40s. But that's really normal, according to the national studies.
Okay. Well, I just, it's been 10 years, and suddenly I'm gaining that weight that I thought was going to happen when I had menopause. And I'm like,
well,
hey.
Weight gain isn't necessarily a function of menopause, right, Dr. Gass?
That's right. That's right. That's more controlled by aging and the fact that we generally spend less energy as we get older. The other thing that works against us is we tend to lose muscle mass if we don't keep using all those muscles. And muscles burn more calories than the rest of our body parts. So it's a combination of these things. And our tissue relaxes. All that nice elastic fiber we used to have relaxes. And so it's like when you had one of those skirts when you were a little girl with the elastic waistband, and then one day you pick it up and the elastic is all shot. And so your middle tends to get bigger even if you haven't gained any weight.
It's like you're sitting right next to me.
I hear you, Ann.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Ann. Marcia in Upper Arlington, you're on the air with Dr. Marjorie Gass. Welcome to the show, Marcia.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call.
You're welcome.
I was just curious if there have been any studies that tie menopause to conditions like alopecia. I have the areata, just small hair loss in my head, and it just seemed to all happen in the past couple years. I'm in menopause. I have hot flashes. I don't take anything. I just kind of deal with it. But just curious, because as I've read about alopecia, in general, it just seems to indicate they don't really know what it's caused from. I don't have any other illness or sickness. And I'll take the answer off air. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you, Marcia.
You're correct that alopecia has not been linked to menopause. And the whole issue of hair is so frustrating for so many women. There's a lot that has to do with genetics, what our family background is in terms of hair loss or extra hair. And so many people experience themselves having hair where they don't want it, and then loss of hair where they do want it. And it's very frustrating. I think whether you go to a gynecologist or a dermatologist, very rarely do we get a great resolution for that problem.
Dr. Gass, we were just talking about dentistry and how dentists aren't usually trained to deal with bad breath issues. And I was wondering, you're a gynecologist. To what extent are gynecologists trained to deal with menopause and working with women on their whatever they may be struggling with in menopause?
Well, they are all supposed to be trained during the course of their residency. Mm-hmm. A lot of times, however, I think that doesn't get as much attention as it should, because gynecologists get wrapped up in learning all the procedures and the surgeries and the obstetrical care and the C-sections. And so learning all of those procedures sometimes takes priority because they feel they need to know that by the time they're done with their training. So that makes it a challenge for some women to then find the right person. Mm-hmm. And one thing we've done at our Menopause Society to try to help that is to create a certifying examination, and it's the NCMP, NAMS Menopause Certified Clinician program, to help women identify people who are really interested. And some, just like all specialties, people in the specialty may gravitate towards something else. They really love OB and they want to do OB all their life, or they like infertility and want to do that all their life. And so it is sometimes a challenge for a woman to find someone truly interested in menopause.
Casey in Cleveland, you're on the air. We're running out of time, but I wanted to get you in. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Thank you, doctor. I'm sorry I joined your show late. My question has to do with, when should a woman consider having a hysterectomy? And I'm always concerned when a woman gets older, their ovaries become more of a haven for a place for failure than for anything else. What do you think?
You've brought up a couple controversial articles. Generally, we only like to take out organs if they're diseased and causing a problem. So, say, for example, a woman has huge fibroids and is bleeding terribly and they can't be controlled and she's fed up with it, that might be an indication. Or if it's just dropping way out with prolapse and it's bothering her because it's dropped so far, those are certainly valid reasons. The ovaries are very debatable, and it depends perhaps on whether you talk to an oncologist, a cancer doctor, or to a general practitioner. Right now, there's still a strong movement to retain the ovaries if they're not causing a problem. However, if women have a history of ovarian cancer in their family or breast cancer related to certain genetic factors, they really would probably benefit by having their ovaries taken out when they're done with childbearing.
Dr. Gass, thanks so much for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Dr. Marjorie Gass, she's a gynecologist and executive director of the North American Menopause Society. Thanks to the All-Side staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Corinne Gleckler, production assistants Karim Shaban, Rose Joe, and Leticia Wiggins, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Ellen DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music, WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Thanks so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.